Now, I don't know what you want in terms of the history. Some of you, I would imagine, would like to know about what it was like when the town was a mining town, but I'll divide them into two segments of remarks, and then I'll answer questions, and we'll just play off of it that way. Let's kind of take it this way. Let's kind of understand what this town represents historically. This is the most successful, probably the only successful, other than the Monte Cristo, most successful non-ferrous mine in the Cascades of Washington State. And when this mine went into production in 1938, after over $4 million worth of investment in it, in developing it from its time of its discovery in 1896 until production in 1938, 42 years, when it went into production, it put to rest a long-held belief about the Cascades that remote regions of the Cascade Mountains could not be mined. That was done with the coming into production in 1938 in April. That destroyed that myth. The Monte Cristo mine to the west had come into production until before World War I, about 1909, but the high rivers and the cost of maintenance of transportation systems caused the Rockefeller Syndicate to close that one down. It was just not profitable, and they ran out of ore. But in 1938, this mining town came into existence. This mine was discovered, officially staked and claimed in 1896 by James Henry Holden, J.H. Holden. I understand one of his four sons will be up here next week. Holden came to the Pacific Northwest in 1888. He was born in Minnesota. He grew up in New York. He came out into the Nevada gold fields and the Comstock, returned to New York, and then with his parents, who were poor and Irish and Catholic, moved west to Iowa. And when he worked for a while there in Iowa, and then the fever hit him again, the mining fever, and he went to Colorado in the 80s. And then in his late 20s, he came out to this area in about 1888. Holden was a man who had aspirations. He wanted to become a well-educated person, and like all prospectors, he wanted to find the mother lode and become rich. And he learned a lot of the techniques of mining on the frontier that a prospector needed. Now, this is a period of time when we're beginning to develop the mining engineer as a well-disciplined, well-educated form of technician. But a man like Holden, who has limited educational background, has got to tie himself to the people who have money and reputations in the Northwest. And in 1888, he comes out here, and in 1889, he meets the famous Denny family, one of the founding families of Seattle. And he becomes a good friend of David Denny's young son, Victor Denny. And the Dennys take him in. He's very down. He's at the end of the road. They develop a kind of relationship, a curious social business relationship, Victor Denny and J.H. Holden. The Dennys are property poor. I mean, they acquire lots of property. They have mining claims at Snoqualmie Pass, and they have lots of real estate, and they have ranches, and they're selling timber off in Seattle, and they're doing rather well, and they're promoting the idea of electric transportation systems and things like that. Holden to them is somebody to employ, to be used around the Denny Mansion out by the Seattle Center where the Space Needle is, or out at the Northgate Shopping Center just outside north of Seattle at their ranch at Licton Springs, but mainly to be used also to work as a camp roustabout on their family vacations. And the rich tended to take their family vacations in the summer, even in the 1890s, on Lake Chelan. And they would come to Lake Chelan, and they would sometimes, by the 1893 period, there would be steamboats, 91, 92, there would be steamboats on the lake. But mainly they would buy about an 18 to 20 foot rowboat, and they would equip it with lots of equipment, either out of Schwabacher's in Seattle or out of Walla Walla. They would create these great expeditions, and they would head up for 3 or 4 weeks up Lake Chelan. And it was not only a pleasure vacation, rowing 55 miles up Lake Chelan and camping along the way. It was also time to go out with some of these people who have a little talent for looking at rocks and maybe stake a claim. And so they used J.H. Holden, and in turn, whenever J.H. Holden had time, he would move on his own. He would then say, he could say, look, I'm with the Denny family. I'm involved in the Holden-Denny relationship. They're my financial backing. Now, the idea was to use Holden. You grubstake him. Equip him for $25 to $40, and if he gets down, you send him another $5. If he's really down, another $10, and make him stay perpetually in debt to you. It's like a lot of these small towns, lumber towns in the Northwest, where you see these idyllic little communities in Puget Sound. Now, you think about these people coming all the way around, bringing their families all the way around to work in a lumber town in the Northwest, and you think about, well, $40 isn't much to have to pay back to somebody after you go to work in a lumber town and all that. Well, $40 is a lot in those days, and it probably would keep you permanently indentured as a servant of the company or whatever it was. We don't think about it that way now because of inflation. Well, anyway, Holden went out, and Holden was a wheeler dealer. He was a prospector promoter. He knew what he was up to. And he came out with these people, and there were already lots of prospectors in the Railroad Creek Valley. And he and the Dennys staked some claims around Railroad Creek, and Holden got the feel of the terrain, and he saw the claims and the mines along the Lake Chelan before the lake was raised by the dam. There was 20 feet difference in the shoreline, and lots of natural spawning grounds for trout now have been destroyed. And he got a good feel of it, and the Dennys came back in 94. He came back with them, and then in 95, the Dennys, we had a panic, a financial depression in 93, and the Dennys couldn't take their big expedition, camp, vacation, and so Holden used his winter time to prepare for his exploration on his own in Lake Chelan. And he came back here in 95, found nothing, had some inkling, he looked the valley over again. This valley had been burnt off before 1891 by prospectors. They think a packer did it, a fellow by the name of W.P. Robinson, before 1891. It would be much easier. That's why a lot of the salalas around here, a lot of this buck brush, it's just a lot easier to do surface prospecting if you've got the whole thing burnt off. It left a lot of dead snags, which you can see still to this day, a lot of dead trees, which were very hazardous, even in the time when, by World War I and after, when people would camp up here, in the middle of the night, these old dead snags would collapse, and there were cases of people getting hurt when they were out backpacking because of the fire in this destroyed valley. Well, anyway, in 1896, Victor Denny got interested again, and the Dennys grubstaked Holden, and Victor Denny and J.H. Holden came up into this valley. And in 1896, the Denny family called Victor back in May, said, Victor, please come home. They started up this way in April, and they worked their way up the valley as the snows receded. And Wes and Werner and a lot of the camp staff here can tell you that it doesn't open up until after May or June. It's really remarkable if it opens up in May, the ground. So about June, by late May, Victor went home. Now Holden was free, in effect. If there was anything this time, he was free to stake and claim. And there were some people that had staked some claims up around the Copper Basin. There were claims down here. There were claims up on the hill on the Holden Lake Trail. And there was potential. So in the summer of 96, in June and July, Denny got on the pack string, and he was taken out, Victor was. And Holden was free then to work this valley. And he worked it very hard on both sides. He records in an Iowa paper, looking back 3 or 4 years later when he went back to Iowa, he tells the incident of how he discovered it like this. On the 24th of July, he was exhausted, it was a hot month, he was tired, and he was without food. His provisions were almost gone. This was it. He had promised to the packer who had brought him up further up the valley, moved him back and forth, anything I find, you're half in it with me, which is a good way of conning people to push you a little bit. He's hungry. He looks for grouse. He walks up this way, up into the slope area. He shoots a grouse. He notes the outcropping. He stakes it. He claims it. He gathers his samples. He gives them to the prospector, to the packer. He sends a letter out to Victor on the 26th. As far as we can tell, it is the 26th of July rather than the 24th of July that is discovered, it takes place. 26th July, 1896, the packer takes out his samples with the letter. He needs more money. He's filing on the claims. He files on the claims in his own name. He takes a series of claims up there where you see those old dumps. Four successive claims. The packer says, what about me? Holden had also staked some claims below that. He said, you can have these. And he says, you can have these two over here that go on around where the old fan was. And so Packer Robinson and his friend Murdoch form a company and call it the Holden Extension. But they don't form it right away. Robinson says, well, I got half of whatever he finds. And in the meantime, Victor Denny in Seattle believes, at least is using Holden, and he says, I've got half of whatever Holden has, except Holden has staked the mine in his own name and Wenatchee to sell this mine, to realize as quickly as possible what he can offer this mine without having to do any work on it. Victor doesn't understand this, but his dad does, because by the time the next year rolls around, by the time Holden, I should say, comes back to Seattle to the mansion at Christmas time at the end of 1896, the family is so poor, the Denny family, Mrs. Denny, the elder David Denny's wife, and they can't even afford shoes. They can't even go to the normal Seattle high society functions because they are too ashamed of their impoverished conditions. They're property poor. That is, you know, they don't have any money, but they have lots of land and lumber companies and real estate. And they've got a traction company that isn't realizing any money. Holden goes back, and David Denny realizes something's up. And what Holden's been doing is he's been sending out his samples to a private assayer, C.E. Bogardus, and also sending out samples to the assay office, National Assay Office, for the Denny's. He's getting two comparative assessments of the value of this, and it's low-grade copper. But the claims are in his name. They're not in Denny's. Goes home, makes provisions, and comes back in 97. And Victor Denny comes back for a while. And then, in 97, Victor Denny disappears. I mean, he goes back to Seattle and works in the family business. And as you know, by 97, there's a Klondike gold rush. And the Denny's then go into helping to make a little money off of a sudden influx of over 100,000 people into Seattle, where if you were going to go north to Alaska, you would need about $1,000 worth of equipment out of Seattle before you headed north for eventual failure to return to live in Seattle and to work in Ballard. Well, anyway, what I'm trying to tell you is this. Holden then continued to work these claims, to hustle the money, to hustle the investment capital from Bogardus, who advanced $250 at 10% interest, which it worked out. He had to pay 45% interest total for a loan that he borrowed from him. And he paid off the Denny's and wiped out that. Now, the elder Denny knew what Holden was up to. So he kept telling Victor, you find out for sure, get in writing, that this is your half, that you're really half in it. In the meantime, Holden moved from 97 through 98 to build these tunnels. And they go all along. There's about five of them. He did all the probes, and he invited all the people in. Holden brought all the people in, his Iowa banker, George Navi, and a whole lot of other people he brought in from Denison, Iowa, and places like that. All these people came in and looked and said, oh, this is really great. People started looking for mines. And Holden also went out and helped sell a mine way above, above Holden Lake, Mary Green Mine. He even realized some money off that. Sold it to some Walla Walla investors. They hadn't so much money, they didn't know what to do with it. Their weak money. And so anyway, he comes back. He comes back in 97, and he works it hard, and he works it hard in 98. And then in 1899, after a long summer of employing people, he forms his company called the Holden Gold and Copper Company. Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. And he capitalizes it for $250,000 and takes majority stock. Okay. Now, David Denny knew exactly But his son, Victor, didn't really want to believe the inevitability of this. 1899, they still get together, they still write friendly correspondence, and don't think, you know, Victor doesn't think too much of it, because they play music together, their trumpets and cornets, and they go socializing and everything. But Victor's getting married, and 1899, Holden's getting married, and, you know, two young fellows, and he really wouldn't hurt me. In 1899, there's a new company. Let me put it this way. Between 1899 and 1905, some big events happen here. He forms his main office, and Holden forms his main headquarters in Chelan, and a branch office, not in Seattle, but in the Spokane Mining Exchange. And there is the Inland Empire. That's the mining exchange capital, where capital can be brought together, where you can get at investment capital to develop mining properties for the eastern British Columbia, Okanagan country, and the north Idaho, and the central Idaho mines, and all of that, and metalling. Now, this shift of emphasis then attracts what we call development, companies of promoters. This one's called Drummers Development. Their specialty is to drill a little bit, but drum up business, drum up some big investor who will buy it and then build it, so that Holden will realize his share, the promotion company will realize their share, and the big company will be stuck with it as a part of their international holdings, and they'll really have to, because they've got the money, they're going to have to put in production. Drummers then goes to work, and they put a crew down, they form what's called a Chelan Smelting and Refining Company, and they put plans on the board, and they start building a road, switchbacks, out of Refrigerator Harbor, and start up the hill where the current switchbacks are, and they start building a road right away between here, and they start building, cutting logs and railroad ties, and they have three work crews working up here to push the ore out, especially this big dump up here, which was called number three, was their big tunnel. That's a big load of ore there, a lot of ore. And so they work on it for about 2 or 3 years on a lease. Now, I want to just make one thing clear to you about Holden. Holden will die in 1918 of cancer. But from the time of his discovery in 1896 until 1918, he becomes one of the most prominent people in North Central Washington, and makes this on the basis of his promoting and making the right connections, going all over the Northwest and the Midwest, California and every place. He makes this into one of the best known low-grade mineral deposits in the far west. And as a matter of fact, he will make so much money off of lease options from Drummers and then the Granby Mining Company, which will take over in 1906, that he will be able to acquire a large red brick mansion overlooking the town of Chelan, about 8 acres of real estate, prime real estate around the town of Chelan. He will be able to put his brother in business. He will move his poor Irish Catholic family, mother and father, and all of his relatives out here. He will do all of this, and he will never have had to really work personally in this mine. He will earn this much, nearly $6,000 worth of lease income off this mine. He's truly a genius in terms of hustling bucks. Really a genius. Now let me put it to you another way. He makes the proper links, and he knows. But to deny your social origins is he wants to become a part of the establishment. And as I said before, although his parents were Irish and Catholic, when he married a lady who was involved in the wooden church at Chelan. And he wanted to be a part of making a community in his own way. He wanted to get a college education, but by the time he was over 30, he had to think about getting an education or making his contribution anyway. He was interested in the arts, musical arts, and so he formed with his wife the first Etude Club, a musical study society. He played the musical instrument, and he imported a conductor to run a band, and he participated in it. He dressed as a mining industrialist. But most importantly of all, to show that he was a part of the mainstream of the American business establishment, he declared that he was English and Episcopalian. while his poor brother Joe continued to deliver milk around Chelan, and everybody made fun of this man who was always looking very nice and taking these trips with his, taking his families on excursions in Puget Sound or to the Coeur d'Alenes or to California for the winter, or driving his carriage around or building a feed store in Chelan or running his stock company. And in 1905 and 6, it was very, he almost lost the company, but 1906, he's able to interest somebody who has a mutual concern for their economic salvation. His name is J.P. Graves. J.P. Graves is the vice president of the largest, he really formed a syndicate, out of the largest mine in the British Empire, the largest copper mine, at the Phoenix Mine near Rosslyn, B.C., the great Granby Consolidated. That mine, the Phoenix Mine, in 1905, its engineers walked in one day and told Graves, said, this mine will bottom out in 2 years. So Graves went personally, quietly at work, to build a find a replacement property, because they had a huge smelter complex up in eastern British Columbia, right over the border, and the railroad trains from Spokane came right to the boundary, and the Canadian Northern Pacific had been built, had been right by his mine, and it was a potential for smelting mines, ores from Washington State as well as from Canada. So that meant that if they could find a replacement, it would be just a quick shift of the Granby effort into Washington or wherever. Holden was well known by 1906. Graves, 1905 and 1906, Graves moved to take control as president and move Holden aside of his company. That was okay with Holden. All he wanted was 50% at 10 cents a share of 1,300,000 shares of stock. And that's fine. That would do him, thank you. Well, anyway, the thing is that Graves went to work, and he brought in his brother and William Yolen Williams and a lot of people. Brought in by 1906 or 7, they brought in heavy equipment. 50,000 tons of mining equipment were brought in here. 50,000 tons were moved up lake. Drills were put in, compressors, pipes, to run to these pneumatic drills, a steam plant over here in the woods, burnt this dead wood that had been left over from the fireblazes, stacked up. If I wouldn't have hiked 40 miles from Rainy Pass, I'd have brought all these slides and you could see them and have popped them on you. Sometime you might see them. They'll be probably, you'll see a lot of them in the book. And they put crews on here, three shifts working all the claims, but focusing mainly upon tunnel number 3, and they went thousands, a couple thousand feet way back. And they worked this from 1906 to 1911. They worked real hard, and they set the road up. They were going to put a railroad out here, and they had it all ready to go. They were going to put into effect a plan that had been established by Drummer's Development, everything but the smelting company at Chelan. The place was going wiggy up here in terms of, and the Holden extension, these old packers are waiting. Maybe they'll buy our claims and we'll make it. And these packers that had the Holden extension would eventually, wouldn't they, make it when the whole Howe Sound Company would buy up all the claims on that side. And they would take their money, turn their horses out to pasture, and disappear into the sunset. And that's literally what happened to them. They couldn't find them after they got their money in 1932. Well, anyway, Graves brought real important attention on it because Graves, as the vice president coordinator of the largest non-ferrous mine and smelter plant in the entire British Empire, was now focusing his own capital and interest, and that meant Spokane, the city of Spokane, upon it. But Graves was smart. He was interested in something else. All along this side of the Cascades was all this tumbling water. And there was a private battle on between a company in Spokane called Washington Water Power and Graves. And Graves' Spokane investment was in traction companies, not for broken arms. Electric railway, street railway systems. And he envisioned being able to build electric traction companies that went to the Palouse, to Coeur d'Alene, to Hayden Lake, to North Idaho, and over here to the Cascades. About that time, remember, the Great Northern had sliced from Wenatchee to Stevens Pass, but nobody had gone over the North Cascades. But there was all this electrical power. And this great future battle in the Northwest over the Northwest's only quickly renewable resource, water, was already shaping up in terms of public versus private. Except in this case, it was two private companies. Graves could marshal the entire Spokane business community, and he could squeeze, in 1903, $30,000 worth of money on the table out of people in a rally to battle Washington Water Power. So he had access to local capital as well as international capital if he needed it. Now, he was able to disguise the fact that they were bottoming out because in 1908, they found another load of ore below the bottom of the Phoenix. So the pressure went off to use this mine. He kept it alive, and that with two other properties, Hidden Creek and Flin Flon. This is the way the mine then set. But the tension in 1906 focused upon this mine caused the Denny family to file a suit. It's one of the tragedies of the Denny family in the latter part of the years, the Denny family at that point, not the modern Denny family, but in the end of the Denny, they were in court a lot of times trying to litigate out some kind of financial return on all their property that didn't turn right for them. They filed a $100,000 suit on Holden, and there, that suit, which we were able to find in the state Supreme records, we found all the correspondence and everything, tells of this wonderful story of Holden and Denny and of how all of the record of the burning prospectors, and this thing went on from 1906 to 1909 till its final appeal. That Victor Denny was the court reaffirmed the decision that it had been Holden's mine, it had been due solely to his effort, that it had gotten to the state that it was, and that Denny really didn't have any right to a half ownership since 1897. He had not upheld his end of the bargain, and everything, he had been paid off. And that's the way it was. So in 1900, the Graves knew that, but Denny's fought it through the court. In 1909, it was cleared up. J.P. Graves gave the presidency back to Holden. Holden was in charge of his own company. And the mine still, though, kind of limped along. And the Granby Company took two or three more lease options. When World War I broke up, they took it. But you see, it's low-grade copper. That means it's less than 3%. And there has to be a tremendous long-term high demand for this kind of copper. Wartime, yes. But Americans didn't get involved on a major scale, a national scale. They didn't commit to that war right away. And the Canadians, they didn't know Britain was in it, but how long? Nobody knew how long we were into that first great war. Imagine planning for how long would war last. In fact, some people had thought that the war shouldn't have, when the swine flu epidemic broke out, that caused a lot of hysteria. But a lot of people didn't expect the war to end in 1918. But by 1914, in order to make a property like this profitable, you had to have a market price for copper of 14.5 cents a pound. So all that they could do with this property, Granby Company did, was they would lease option it, and they would try to develop with their engineers a more precise body of knowledge about how much tonnage was here. And they were able to examine it, and they were able to separate it into two. There were two ore bodies. There was an ore body, a large one with over a million ton of ore, in those along where those old dumps are up high, and they drilled down by 1916, they drilled down and found the possibility of the top of another ore body. And then the war ended abruptly in 1918, but before it did, in 1915, Crooker Perry, a Chelan orchardist who moved out here, turn of the century, 1915, Crooker Perry went to San Francisco to visit his mother. And in February of 1915, he won the San Francisco lottery worth $20,000. And when he came back, J.H. Holden went over to see him. And he talked him out of a $7,500 loan. And he got that loan on a promise that he would pay it back at 10% interest starting one year later. Or he would lose his property and all that. Now, why did he do that? Well, it was just quickly this. When you hire the Folletto and the Pistono brothers and all their miners from the Heart Lake mine and the Aurelia Crown Point Falls mine, and you bring them down here to work during the year, and you don't pay them to do the assessment work, then they, as well as the merchants, have a lien on the property. And that's really what the miners want. If you don't pay us, we have first lien on your mine. So he had to get the money to pay off his back debts in order to keep his mine alive. Keep his mind. And so he got this loan of $7,500 on interest, and he kept the mine alive. And then, as I said before, Granby took one more look at it in 1916 and 17, and they decided, no, we don't want it, but we think there's maybe the possibility of 2 million plus tons of low-grade ore. But nobody wanted to take the chance because they didn't know when the war would end. Only the Americans were trying to drum up to stand. Apparently, from what we can understand, they thought possibly the war would go longer than that because they came into it last. They didn't understand the Russians wanted out of it first. But anyway, anyway, the point is that in 1918, in the spring, Holden, his condition got worse, and so he had to go to Spokane for some operations, and he didn't make his payment, his first payment, and the banker, the Crooker Perry, he's got $7,500 plus 10% interest coming to him, which is about $8,000, close to $9,000, but that's not the money, and all they have is the property, and nobody wants property that bad. And so Holden dies in May of 1918, and here's this mine. It, with debts against it, liens against it by a man who's loaned Holden money. Here are these miners who will continue to do the assessment work under the rules of the company. They make them do it every year. And they have liens against him. Here are these miners who will continue to do the assessment work under the rules of the company. They make them do it every year. And they have liens against him. And there's the Granby Company. Will they want to pick up an easy mine? Who knows? And the railroad in 1914 came from Wenatchee to the Okanagan country. So it's accessible. What's more, anybody in the right mind, Holden saw this, and he said it before he died, to get that ore out, we will use that new invention called the truck. That's the low-cost way, because the railroad raises the cost and makes it not worth considering, because the cost of building railroads was, well, how do you put a mine into existence? What streams do you use for your water power? Do you use Heart Lake or Donkey Lake? Do you divert Railroad Creek? And if you do those things, do you pollute the river? Where are you going to smelt this ore? How are you going to break it, concentrate it, break it, move it? How are you going to ship it? How are you going to do these things? Where are you going to get the power source from to run this mine? You can't use any trees. So what do? But there isn't a nearby power dam yet. That won't be built in Chelan until the 1920s. So you don't have a cheap source of electricity there. What do you do? Crooker Perry says, I don't know what you do between then and 1938. But I want my money back. So he has to figure out a way of getting control of the Holden Gold and Copper Company. And he does a lot of maneuvering. He wants to sell it. But to sell it, he's got to have control of the mine. He's president of it, sure. But he has to fight the bank, which Holden had given the stock, his common stock, to a bank to hold and not to be released unless Holden signed the release. So Holden's dead. How do you get the court to authorize the sale of the stock? You've got to get, Perry has to figure out how to get that court to give him the power to be administrator, to release Holden's stock in order to put it out in front of the courthouse on public auction in order to have the right to buy majority control in a company which owes him $9,000. It's a complicated deal because maybe Graves will send somebody over to Wenatchee to buy up the majority stock. And maybe Mrs. Holden, sitting down there, she won't want to be relieved by the court of being the administrator of the estate. And what about the Wenatchee Commercial Bank? Does it necessarily want to give away stock that may 20 years from now prove valuable? And what about the lawyers for Mrs. Holden? These young lawyers starting out, maybe And what does Perry do? His lawyer is an alcoholic. He says this stock is worthless eventually, that he had a shares of it, and handed $400,000 of it, worth 400,000 shares of it, to his secretary. He says, you can have this post. What does he do? He has to then sit down and prepare his own defense and his own legal battle in the court against Holden's wife's lawyers, who also want the stock, against the bank, which also wants the stock, against an alleged fourth party, the Granby Company, or maybe the Graves themselves, because you see, J.P. Graves got real ill, and he was released from the Granby because they found out that he really did conceal evidence from them, so he took a sick leave, but he had so much money coming in that he didn't know what to do with it. In fact, Graves' real contribution beyond mining is that he founded Whitworth College. Founded it and kept it up. He was one of its major guiding posts until he died in 47. So you have four contenders. And what does this cost Crooker Perry, the banker orchardist in Chelan? He has $20,000 in San Francisco Lottery. By 1922, he tallies it up and he has over $21,000 of his own money tied up in this company. Well, you know, the court does all the maneuvering and gives Perry the right to be administrator, and it happens. Graves doesn't send anybody, so that eliminates. The bank decides in court, well, they're not going to have a shot at it, so the bank relinquishes it. They're forced to, so they're out of it. Now it's between Perry and a mythical enemy out there, but the mythical enemy never shows up, and he acquires the stock, but he still hasn't sold the mine. Now begins the real problem. This mine is well known. By now, engineers are a dime a dozen throughout the Northwest. They've been turning them out of engineering schools, mining engineering schools, for years. You could hire them cheaper than teachers. Sorry about that. But you can. And engineers don't like that. And they're a new breed. They're really a new breed. They have lace boots and they have pantaloons. They're called the Lace Boot Brigade. And they're really technicians. And they're all trying to find that mine that they can become superintendent of. Well, because if they are able to say, look at all these claims that we've located this year, this one's good, and they get the company to buy it, then they get the right to go out and guide it into existence. And if it comes out to be big, wow, look at, they're a big mining engineer. And they get, you know, the company will promote them, and they'll go right to the top of the organization. Now, the information about the Holden mine is kept alive as much by the Granby Company through its engineering offices as it was by the efforts of Holden and others to always drop into a newspaper office and tell a lie or a little white lie to a newspaper man. Okay, and so what happens is that by 1928, Perry gets a lot of these letters out, and he asks these engineers, and they write back and forth across the industry, across the between nations. And finally, a new company, a company up in Vancouver, Britannia Beach. An engineer goes to work at Britannia Beach, and this engineer, his name is C.B. Brennan, and he had been working in the Phoenix Mine office, and he knew all about it. He was really intrigued by it, and as soon as he got the job as chief field explorations officer, he asked Howe Sound to buy it. And they came up, took one quick look, bought it, agreed to pay $240,000 for it. Perry had half the interest in the mine, so he realized his share off of it. 1928, it was sold, and they paid it off in four installments, and then two phases take place. Howe Sound moves about 100 miners onto this site, starts sawing logs off of here, stacking lumber. They send a crew up way up above, just by that lower dump, that big dump, and build a camp, and they work at it until 1931 when the Depression hits, and then they don't resume operation again until 1936, and the crew moves on, and in January of 1937, with no switchbacks here yet on the roads, no completed road yet, with only three dumps up there, lots of tunneling and all that, and they've done their own tunneling and everything, with the pollution problem solved, having reached compromises with the State Game Commission, everything, in 1937 in January, in Vancouver, Virginia Beach, a decision is made to put this mine into production within 1 year. And this town, then, is a miraculous achievement, if you think about it. that this town was put together in 1 year. In January they decided, in April they had their headquarters at Lake Chelan. They started moving equipment up in March, April, May. But they continued to cut more lumber, import some lumber, use as much of the local stuff as they could, hauled in their cement on their barges, built their barges at Chelan, built their tug at Chelan, you know, and started hauling things up in tractors, pushing the snow aside. They had to have hearings on the power line right away. With the Federal Power Commission, there was little opposition. They had to figure it out, and they had to cut the right-of-way. You know, you see how they had to place this right-of-way for the power line. They had to do all of that. They got the electricity hooked up in January of 38. One year later. They had their own steam, and they had their own, just like you did, their own diesel-propelled power supply. They got these buildings up in 38, and they eventually... They kept most of the families down there, some up here, and then they moved them down here as more room was made up above. For 39, most of everybody was here. But in April, by April 7th of 1938, they were shipping concentrate. And no one expected it to run more than crushing 1,000 ton of rock a day. They had no idea. They were building, they built, they knew their mill could handle more. They thought it could. They were absolutely surprised, though, that they were running 2,000 ton of rock a day within the first 6 months. But the thing, the really stirring story about this whole era, I think, is the monumental achievement in building this, putting this mine into existence in 1937 through 38. They had a tram up the gully by the switchbacks. They hoisted these diesel engines and these everything up. And you had to go off Dan's camp at the top of the switchbacks, and it was over there, and there's the loading platform, and they brought it all, and they'd haul it in with trucks and that on a very rough road. And they had hundreds of people working on this. But still, think about all you workers here with all these rocks to move around and all this to put up, and looking at the foundations that you continue to repair. Yeah, it must have been a fantastic job. It was dangerous. It wasn't too dangerous, actually. Only two people lost their lives in the construction of the mine itself. And those were not mine-related accidents. There was two in the construction and two before that. One in 30, one fellow had he got the flu or some kind and died up here. Another fellow drilled into a rock and things blew up and the shrapnel hit him in the eye and hurt him and he was dead before they got him out here. Those are the only one underground. Building a dock, a fellow died of shock in Wenatchee Hospital from his arm and fingers getting mangled as they were building this ramp for the boat where they used to bring him up. And another person was killed in a rowboat. They were stringing the cable from Prince Creek to Bear Creek across the lake, south of Donkey Mountain there. And the wind came up and whipped the boat around, and the guy fell out of the boat, and they tried to use dynamite to blow his body back up out because of the water, pulsing down at cold water. But that was it. Lots of little accidents, and there was only a couple of deaths during the whole life of the mining community. Okay, well, that's basically how it got into existence, I mean, in brief form. And sketchy, very sketchy. They'll be in book form. With a lot of photos, it'll be in book form. We hope, for sure, next year. It'll be out by next year. Any questions?
Maybe the question is going to take place outside between now and they're going to be eating lunch here. If you have a session starting right
now. Yeah, let's take another 10 minutes. I think people want to be in dialogue here. Okay. Any questions about then or during the mining year? What? It'll be called the History of the Holden Mine from Discovery to Production, 1896-1938. What?
About the story that Holden was up here with the surveying for the railroad.
No, that's completely erroneous. We cannot find any. I've looked in all the railroad exploration reports and there's no evidence that he was.
Why do they call it Railroad Creek?
Why do they call it Railroad Creek?
Well,
it was named that, as far as we can tell, in a Northern Pacific expedition done here in the 1870s of a and there was another expedition here before the area was opened in 1885. Basically, by the time Rogers brought his Great Northern Expedition here in 1889, it was being called Railroad Creek. The Northern Pacific surveyed on the west side, and coming this way looking for routes, and they came up here. There's a couple of allusions to it, but no details on the Northern Pacific expeditions of that period, 1877 and after. But Rogers uses it in his 1886 report. So we do know that the term is around by no later than 1886, and perhaps as early as 1877.
Did I understand in your introduction this morning that you lived here for 10 years?
I came here when I was 2 months old in 1939, and I lived here until the mine closed in 57.
Your father was employed by that?
Yeah, my father was a 10th person who was employed here. That means that they had a little thing, a hiring number. When you were hired here at Chelan, they screened you and then hired you. They stamped a number on it. It's your number, your TIN number, your employment number, your identification number. And he was 10, number 10. And that meant that then you were, and that's the way they identified you on the payroll check and things like that.
He came in 39.
He came in 38.
38,
what was the nature then of the community life here?
Well, it was as quiet as it is now. I imagine from talking to Wes, it wasn't as quiet as it was last week. But it was about like this. It was not as, it was the hub of the community was the rec hall, with the movies going upstairs, non-denominational services on Sunday. We housed the visiting minister, who spent most of his evening around my father's home brew crock, and neighbor Dandelion Wine, discussing theology in a very profound way next to the wood stove. And most of the guys gathered there for their church service, and most of the mothers would take the children down here to the rec hall for a traditional service. And the miners kept a priest employed at the 1500 level at all times, because the miners always wanted that kind of, apparently wanted that kind of spiritual reassurance that when they got hurt. And this man who worked, they had a man employed who worked in the timber shed and was immediately available if they called in any accident. He would go underground to be with them, to aid and comfort them. Community life? People were here to conquer nature, not work with it. Miners and lumbermen are here to conquer nature. They were in a battle with nature. Theirs was a respect for nature because they couldn't conquer. And if they couldn't conquer without an ice axe or any other adjunct, crampons, you know, they knew the mountain had them. If the mountain could free them, when they were hunting a mountain, it would cliff them. You know, they didn't like to climb mountains. They would go fishing and hiking. They could conquer it that way. They were not big, that big. There were some that were in the mountain climbing. But basically, they were content living within the confines of the village. A very small percentage of them actually did the hiking and fishing. Only one that I know of went to the Dole Lakes, caught a couple of fish, had them on display under ice in the rec hall. Most of the time, they were very pleased to be able to get off ship and to sit on the benches around the town and feed the squirrels and relax and enjoy it. Okay? If they wanted other forms of relaxation, since the alcohol was not allowed in the town, tavern, they had to go to the CERN, they would bring it in or make it themselves. They had a fee they paid, a community club fee, which went for their Christmases. The Christmases, their Labor Day, their 4th of July, at the end of school, these were all important times to celebrate, and they pulled out the plugs in terms of letting the money roll. $5 to a kid who ran the distance of the ballpark first for first place, $3 for second, $2 for third, and 50 cents for every kid who tried. They had a whole series. That's the whole picnic, the whole area there, the whole town congregated. They moved all the food up to the end of town. They had a picnic, they had a ball game, they brought in visiting, you see the picture of the visiting teams. Then they would bring out the truck with all the pop and beer on it and all the ice cream, and everybody would sit there and just have a good time. And they would have an all-night dance. The music would end at midnight, and then they would throw money on the stage to keep the band going as long as the money kept going, and then probably longer. But they, Christmas, as Wes and Werner probably told you, they had all the presents. A lot of presents were brought in, especially hand-wrapped by one of the major Seattle Spokane department stores in stocking, and they had a regular big program. But remember, this is also a community which discriminated in its hiring, It was typical of American society at that time. Mexican Americans and Mexican Americans were safe miners, but they did not allow. They kept. There were no blacks here. Only until the end were there. Really, there were a few Mexican Americans. Basically, they were looking for a special type of person. That person, those families stayed here through World War II. And there was a turnover then, and there was a turnover at the end of the Korean War. And it was very hard then to get the same kind of person. They needed people so bad after the Korean War that the quality of people in the community then went down. Social clubs, women especially had rules that no shop talk took place in social clubs. There was already a geographic discrimination area here, wasn't there, Werner? You could see it. There would be the workers at that end of town and the administration staff and those in the circle that was called the circle. And you could move from, if you were a mine shift boss and you got the mine foreman promotion job, it was a $10 a month pay raise and the right to live in the circle. Didn't have a sauna or a jacuzzi. There's an old swimming pool out there. And the miners here. So there was a geographical obstacle that separated the communities a little bit. Although people didn't worry about it. Another thing they didn't worry about was locking their doors. No one locked their doors. If you were hungry, you went in and had something at the dinner table, but nobody locked their doors. As for the problem of single miners living two in a room, no. There seemed to be few of those kinds of problems. You see, working underground or working in places like this, even if you had a doctor up here, you still had a long ways, and you still have a long ways to go. So it was very important that you worked as a team. They hired one new man on my dad's crew and put him on my dad's crew during the war. One new man. My dad, he had an assignment to do, and that was to put up a warning sign beside a stove. Now the team lived together in a section of town. They knew each other closer than brothers. That person was new and lived down here. He was told to do it. He didn't put up the sign. My father walked off in the dark and was in the hospital for 4.5 months. Practically all of his bones broke. Fell 100 feet down a raise. Very important to understand that people felt a sense, a strong, men at least, felt a very strong kinship to each other and did not discriminate against each other as a part of work. They were united from the picking up of, from the breaking of ore down to the milling of it, the removal of it. They had to be. That was their strength. It was a welcome. And so nobody, so you wouldn't feel racial discrimination. You wouldn't feel that because it would be removed from you. And you wouldn't feel other personal discriminations because you were single. Right? And they all knew who the town gambler was. And they knew he cheated. But there were no gunfights at the OK Corral. They just tried to keep him honest. Okay, any questions? Yes?
There have been a lot more pictures this year that we've noticed of the mine. Where have these pictures been, and how were you able to locate them?
I picked them up from a photographer who's now dead. He has about a 15,000 glass collection, Laurie Lindsay. And other people have donated pictures to me over the it's been nearly 10 years since we began the removal. Rudy Edmonds and Werner Jensen saw to the removal of the records from down in the basement. And it's been a 10-year effort. I'm going all over, and I've caught them in Canada, get them from private people, and like last year, ORB, doing that consulting job for the Forest Service on the tailings, they borrowed some for their report, they borrowed some of my pictures, and they slip out. And I've got about 8 trays now, not only over the exploration and the discovery and the development, but also over the town life and the milling and the mining and the transportation system and the closing of it, things like that. Go on for hours. And they just, yes?
How did it feel when...
This may be the last question so we can get to the other session.
Okay.
How did it feel when it became evident that the village was going to close? What kind of reaction occurred?
For somebody like me, a senior just graduated from high school?
You were probably ready to leave anyway.
Well, I never knew what the precise term was to call it until I went away to school, until somebody gave me a precise term. I guess the old-timers called it melancholia. But psychologists, I guess, call it the state of anemia. And I'd lost my father on Lincoln's birthday in 1957 and graduated from in February and graduated in June, and the mine closed in July. So by the time I got back here in June, many people were already leaving, and so many houses were already empty, and there were rocks in some windows, but not all. And I was already in a state of, you know, like any young person would be. Many people sat outside their houses on their porches at night and had their record players and radios out on the lawns, and many people sat in the large dining hall, mess hall, and in the coffee shop and talked to each other, kind of like not really wanting to believe that it was happening. And yet the miners had been defensively trying to save jobs and put off the decision for at least a year before that, fighting to renegotiate the contract to keep more people employed, to keep it alive, to keep it going, to keep it going. But by February, everybody knew it was over. It's just a matter of when, and they knew when it was going to take place in July, and they knew that when it took place, that it meant everybody would have to go. And I guess the town, from some of you who were here to put it back together, Wes can probably tell you about this. The town, except for the scavengers that came into it, the town had, excluding the effect of the weather damage, the town had had that appearance, didn't it? Yeah, but it had the appearance that they'd be back in a few days.
Wasn't anything left. Now, the myth always is when guests come up here, they say, we've heard that the miner pulled out of your cellar and left towels on the line, dishes on the table, clothes hanging. It wasn't true at all. It was an entire myth.
We cut a hole in the wall of our house, backed a truck into it, took everything we could. That's right, and that was not uncommon. Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah. The people to really talk to about that are the people who have made this into the much better town, with a much better feeling than in the past, because it's interesting to put the story back together how it came to be. But I think it's more important, I think it's really, really neat to look ahead to what it is and what it stands for and what it will continue to be. That's what I think is really neat, you know. And they have a reunion every year in Chelan, and a lot of people don't want to deal with change, as Werner and I were talking about this morning. And many of the people that came to this 19th reunion, this about 3 weeks ago, were the people who were here from the 1938 to 1946 period. But they don't want to come up here. No, they don't want to come up here. But those who have come up here continue to tell them, you know, that it's better than it was then, and it's important to see it, and it's important to learn how to cope with the fact of change. And in this case, the change has been, at least from my point of view, not for the better, but for the best, really the best. You know, and I hope that, you know, that the thing that comes out of it is 19 years later, people still get together who lived at Holden. And I got the funny feeling that if this community were to suddenly go its way, I would imagine somewhere 19 years from the point of the closing of Holden Village, people would still get together. At least I would hope that that sense of community would be there. And I, you know, what's really amazing is that you are able to see these bonds build amongst those. I've had an opportunity to attend some of the Lutheran gatherings, the Holden Village gatherings, and you know, just very brief visits to the mine, to the community, the village, have caused that. Gee, just think what it'd be like if you were here for 19 years. Well, maybe you'd be writing books. Well, thank you very much. I gotta go get my pen.